this is a wonderful honor, and I'm really so so thrilled to be able to receive this award and to be able to say a few words to you. I hope it won't be more than a few, but I did take a little time to pull together something that addresses this important topic of alleviating the global burden of cancer. What I would like to do is to touch upon the dimensions of the burden of cancer briefly, and then emphasize the issues relating to tobacco carcinogenesis, which is just an instructive paradigm for us in how we effectively intervene in cancer control. Talk about the important theme of obesity, energy expenditure, and dietary guidelines, some of which we've been hearing a considerable amount in the news media. List then some of the priorities as I view them in cancer control that will achieve major reductions in cancer mortality if they're successfully implemented, and then to pay brief tribute to Dr. Snow. Here is a snapshot of the global cancer statistics with a global population of about 6 billion and to indicate what the total number of cases are and the top three cancer sites throughout the world. In fact, in 2020, where we project a population of about 7.5 billion, the lower limit of that estimate is about 15 million cases. The deaths are indicated here. 2020, about 10 to 12 million deaths per year. And the ranking of the three top cancer sites. I'll speak a little bit about that toward the end, because some of these major cancer sites throughout the world are really attributed to microbial agents, and that's a very important aspect of our alleviating the global burden of cancer. And the total number of global deaths and the percentage due to cancer, 12-13%, whereas in our own country, it's 23%. These are some of the brief insights into USA cancer statistics, and I wanted to just dwell a little bit on the last item. It's clear now that over 200,000 new cases of cancer per year that we're seeing are occurring in patients who've had a previous primary cancer. And for the epidemiologist, that poses a challenging question. Are these random chance events? Are they the result of the careful medical diagnostic follow-up that we provide to cancer patients, or are there predictive patterns that allow us to look at some of the common underlying determinants of cancer and that give rise to cancers at multiple sites, those that relate to tobacco and alcohol, those that relate to reproductive hormones, those that relate to genetic factors and familial clustering of cancers and hereditary syndromes. And another important aspect is the relationship with the treatment of the index primary cancer. The fact that the chemotherapeutic agents we use, so-called alkylating agents, for example, may give rise to secondary leukemias within the 3 to 10 year period after the diagnosis of that first cancer, or subsequently the radiation therapy giving rise to solid organ cancers in breast, thyroid, lung, and GI tract. It's of interest that although we're seeing now downward trends for the major killer diseases of heart disease, cancer, and stroke, that cancer is now surpassing heart disease for a broad range of age groups, even though heart disease is ranked number one. When we look at this and with these bar graphs, we can see the dramatic decreases that are taking place for cardiovascular disease mortality, about 6.5% per year, attributed to the interventions that we're providing with respect to treatment, as well as the ability now to modify the important risk factors through medication, as well as through lifestyle changes. A factor that is going to act against this possibly is the increasing prevalence of obesity, as well as the sedentary lifestyle of our population. In the last, say from 1993 on, the cancer mortality for our country peaked about 1992, we begin to see a regular decline, about 1.1% per year over that period of time, which would mean about 5,000 less cancer deaths per year. Then the last 2 years, 2002 to 2004, we were able to observe an acceleration in the decline, with now 2.6% per year decline on per year in males and about a 1.8% in women. 40% of the declining cancer mortality in men may be attributed to declining lung cancer. Now let me just speak about the cancer burden of tobacco. These are some of the salient statistics, and it's important to observe that the estimate is for environmental tobacco smoke about 3,000 lung cancer deaths per year. We also see how many lung cancer deaths have been prevented or postponed in USA men as a result of reductions in cigarette smoking. The fact that in women the rates of increase have declined, but we're still only seeing approaching a plateau rather than an actual decline in absolute rates. These are the major cancer sites that we attribute to tobacco, and these are well-established now associations. Lung cancer deaths comprise about 80% of all the smoking attributable cancer deaths. The lifetime risk of lung cancer in a continuing current smoker is around 15%, or roughly 5 cases per 1,000 person years of cigarette use. This brings in then our consideration of the multiple factors that are important in the natural history of lung cancer, as well as the interaction of genes with key environmental risk factors such as tobacco. We may catalog them as genes that are involved in the metabolism of chemical carcinogens, genes that are involved in the capacity and fidelity of our DNA repair mechanisms, the polymorphisms of genes that affect inflammatory cytokines, and as a general principle, chronic inflammation comprises a pathway that enhances or potentiates carcinogenesis. We've become to really appreciate that as it is a factor in cardiovascular disease. And then, of course, the genes and biochemical mechanisms by which we have intractable addictive behavior. These are some of the genetic loci that are now being investigated and trying to disentangle really the complexity of gene-environment interactions as they affect individual susceptibility. It should be emphasized that these profiles of genetic polymorphisms and their enzymatic expression or activity may vary by race, by ethnicity, by gender, cell type, by level of smoking or other lifestyle factors, and importantly, to look at gene-gene interactions, so that it's probably not sufficiently informative to just look at one single locus. These are the interventions that we would advance to try to control either the initiation or achieve cessation of tobacco smoking. Remember, we have about 44.5 million cigarette smokers, many of whom are hardcore. But as we look at the different factors, one is the economic aspect of the tobacco products and this whole concept of elasticity of tobacco demand in relationship to increasing costs. Second is to regulate the smoke-free environment in public places and public transportation, adopting and implementing effective health warning labeling in the packaging of tobacco products, and the availability of appropriate and well-trained counseling services that achieve behavior modification. the availability of pharmacologic therapies, such as those that are replacing nicotine as patches, inhalers, sprays, and gums, and the use of antidepressants that are used in conjunction with psychotherapy. Restrictions on tobacco industry advertising, particularly as they target certain ethnic groups and our young adult population. And finally, the important initiative, I believe, that we're now considering in legislation of a congressional intervention to elevate, this is the Food and Drug Administration, regulation of tobacco production, distributing, marketing, labeling, so that we can establish minimal national standards. Both of those bills, particularly under the heading of the Family Tobacco Control Act and Prevention Act, are under consideration by the House of Representatives and the Senate, and they're now trying to solicit comments from the public. In a way, as I indicated, tobacco carcinogenesis is this paradigm that's instructive in how we achieve a multi-pronged approach toward cancer prevention and control. Biobehavioral research, molecular biology, importance of epidemiology, cancer surveillance, and then with that knowledge synthesis, the implementation of intervention programs that address behavior modification, screening and early detection, chemo prevention, and environmental regulation. The outcomes will be the altering of risk factor prevalences, incidence, mortality, disability, and the quality of life. Let me shift a bit now to nutrition that's going to receive more and more attention in the media with the issuing of some mammoth report that's coming from the World Cancer Research Fund report that just convened a conference a few days ago. This is the 2005 dietary pyramid that you're all familiar with. Every 5 years now, the USDA, Department of Agriculture, and Department of Health and Human Services prepare this radiant pyramid with the distribution of food items and with it also the emphasis on physical activity. We should recall the so-called Mediterranean diet with the abundance of plant foods, fruits, vegetables, whole grain cereals, nuts, and legumes, olive oil, canola oil, the monounsaturated fatty acids, its principal sources of fat, fish and poultry in contrast to red meat, as their effect then on reducing coronary events as well as certain cancer sites, restriction of trans fatty acids, and also to lower the dietary glycemic load. I found it helpful to look at the dietary mediated pathways by which we may look at diet and cancer. Toxic chemicals contained in foods or produced in food preparation, the endogenous formation of carcinogens derived partially from food sources. This gets into the preserved meats that have nitrate preservatives and nitrosamine pathway, or in the grilling, roasting, and frying of proteins, meats that give rise to heterocyclic amines. Dietary deficiencies associated with neutralization of oxygen-free radicals that would become impaired, methylation of DNA, DNA synthesis repair, methylation being a very important pathway in regulating gene expression and how the single carbon metabolism provided by folic acid and methionine, biotin, B12, B6 are so important in an epigenetic way and how we can regulate and modulate appropriately gene expression. Deficiencies of those nutrients may heighten our individual susceptibility and the integrity of the cell-mediated immunity. The other aspect is excess energy consumption, obesity, and insulin resistance, and then the non-digestible fibers that affect greater transport of mutagens within the fecal stream in the gastrointestinal tract. So let's just talk about two factors before I conclude, namely obesity and cancer. Dysfunctional disparity between energy intake, mechanisms controlling appetite and satiety, and energy expenditure would comprise really our understanding of the effect of obesity. Recall that a 3,500 excess kilocalorie diet in terms of energy intake would result in 1 pound gain in weight. And one can see how this could be insidiously increasing over a period of time. I've given some of the estimates of the prevalence of obesity, and if the current trends are extrapolated by the year 2010, more than 40% of the population will be classified as obese. The estimate globally at present is 1.3 billion people. And I recall in King Henry IV, the Falstaff comment, banish plump Jack and you banish all the world. Not quite, but we're getting perhaps in that direction. These are the sites that are associated with obesity. And importantly, they are the sites that reflect upon some of these mechanisms about which I spoke. The American Cancer Society has estimated that 15 to 20% of cancer deaths in women and 10 to 14% of cancer deaths in men are attributed to obesity. These are the mechanisms by which I believe obesity is contributing to these adverse neoplastic sequelae. Sex steroid production, the whole syndrome of hyperinsulinemia, insulin resistance, and the elevated production of growth factors like the insulin-like growth factor, altered bile acid metabolism, cholelithiasis, and gallbladder cancer, dyslipidemia, coronary heart disease, the importance of central or intra-abdominal adiposity, and remember that the adipocytes and their excess production of these different growth factors really constitute a pro-inflammatory syndrome. Here is the Physical Activity Association and the benefits that have been achieved with respect to colon cancer, breast, endometrial cancer, possibly prostate cancer. And the mechanisms by which we believe this is occurring are partially in its relationship to central obesity, but also the fact that it enhances insulin sensitivity, reduces endogenous production of sex steroid hormones, it reduces the production of inflammatory biomarkers, and also provides a more rapid intestinal rate of transport. Which then leaves me with what I believe could be some of the priorities for achieving reduction in the burden of global cancer mortality. I've spoken about tobacco. I've spoken about tobacco in conjunction with alcohol, and that more than 50% of global deaths due to cancers of the upper airway and digestive tract may be attributed to these two lifestyle factors. Reducing the tumorigenic effects of exposure to microbial agents, where 20 to 25% of cancer mortality in developing countries and 7 to 10% of cancer mortality in industrialized countries. And here, immunization, antimicrobials, surveillance would be important. And the importance of achieving optimal weight and the balance of energy expenditure and energy intake. Adherence to the recommendations and guidelines with respect to screening and early detection, possibly prostate cancer with more evidence, and also the availability, accessibility of optimal treatment methods to our population without disparities in those minimal standards of care. And finally, I too would like to pay tribute to John Snow. In virtually every school of public health, our students learn about John Snow and his classic publications about the mode of transmission of cholera. His second edition of a classic publication was published in 1855, 3 years before his death at age 45. His keen observational insights and rejection of contemporary dogma were constructed on a solid foundation of medical and scientific reasoning. He was indeed a profile in courage and professional integrity. With its reward, we honor him, and I am profoundly appreciative of receiving this award in his name. Thank you.
As we're getting ready to introduce the next award winner. interview another leader in the field of epidemiology, Dr. Michelle A. Williams, a distinguished professor in the Department of Epidemiology and the founder, co-director, and PI of the Multidisciplinary International Research Training Program. Both of those are at the University of Washington School of Public Health and Community Medicine in Seattle, Washington. As the APHA Epidemiology Section Abraham Lilienfeld Award winner. Just a brief note on the MERC project, the Multidisciplinary International Research Training Program provides support for undergraduates and graduate students to do health-related population-based research and training in developing countries. We'll say a little bit more about that in a second. And now, as the model of this this award to recognize excellence in the teaching of epidemiology during the course of the career, Dr. Abraham Lilienfeld was one of the fathers of modern epidemiology that saw his mission to rigorously train epidemiologists and other public health professionals to use the tools of epidemiology. In someone else's words, quote, Abe made things happen. He was a visionary, yet pragmatic, devoted to his craft. Though mindful of its limitations, rigorous in the pursuit of excellence, and warmly supportive and encouraging of students and colleagues, his legacy as teacher and scientist has been the advancement of education and training at schools of public health and the attraction of young, scholarly, and inquisitive minds into our discipline. Transcending all this is the memory of a compassionate, caring, unpretentious man who was able to extract the best from all of us because he wished it to be so. And I'd like to acknowledge the person that wrote that. That was Dr. Schottfeld in 1989. Thank you so much. So what the award committee, well, the awards committee and I learned about is that Dr. Williams is the living embodiment of such excellence and compassion. Her teaching and mentoring is brilliantly holistic. She works to both balance the scientific rigor needed in training with the humanity and compassion and perhaps even love needed by those under her wings to grow and become successful epidemiologists as well as people. She expects a lot and gives a lot. From the testimonies that we saw testimonial after testimonial from folks that are here in the U.S. as well as from other countries around the world. She is, you get the impression that she is a tireless translator of the technical rigor of epidemiologic and a broader scientific methodologies, but still making these methods come alive in her students' imaginations and their subsequent work. She also challenges those who she works with to think carefully how their work can actually make a difference in the lives of people, especially those in great need. What is obvious about Dr. Williams is that she is first and foremost an epidemiologist and an inspiring teacher. Over her career path thus far, it is easy to see that Dr. Williams has been extremely dedicated and inspiring as a teacher of epidemiology. She clearly shows her engagement and love for her craft and her students. She clearly cares that her students and professional colleagues really are grounded in the methods and processes of epidemiologic research and that they properly apply those rigorous methods and the questions that they try to answer, as well as to learn how to ask the important questions that need to be answered using those skills. You also get the impression that she clearly encourages independence and innovation, but is extraordinarily available to shepherd those who she's committed herself to. She meets her students where they are and holds the bar high nonetheless and tries to help them reach their goals and dreams. I feel personally honored to to have reviewed her career and the materials that we received, which began about 17 years ago after she received her doctoral degrees. Though the many, through the many voices of the students, faculty, and other colleagues that have talked or wrote about her to us. And I noticed one overarching theme about her and her chosen role with students and colleagues. She clearly has been a dream maker for her students. And I'll say a little bit more about that. Dr. Williams is the daughter of Jamaican immigrants with less than 12 years of formal schooling between them. Grew up in Queens, New York, attended public schools, and aspired to go to college on a sports scholarship. And she recalled in a recent article about herself, quote, "I was trying to get a volleyball scholarship when one of my teachers told me to reach higher and handed me an application to Princeton. I got into Princeton, an elite school that was out of my vision. So many horizons are artificially low because we don't have the experience or the exposure to reach higher." She studied developmental genetics and molecular biology with Eric Weishaus, who won a Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1995. And she quotes a little bit something. "When I met him, I said, I want to be in your lab and even wash your test tubes. When I returned to his lab after that initial meeting, he had cleared out space for me on the bench, and I began to study embryonic development of fruit flies. To be in this space and to work right alongside him was incredible. I was just an undergraduate, and I fell in love with the beauty of science. Pardon me, and silence sometimes, I'm sure. And then commenting later, she just won a distinguished award at UW. She connected that experience by saying that she created the MERC program to allow minority students to have an international experience, something that I didn't have until I was a graduate student. Well, someone else that she closely works with summarized her dream-making role by saying, most importantly, she believes in equality. Her often saying one's birthplace shouldn't be a predictor to have an opportunity to excel in this world. She means that, walks the talk. I want to say something about her academic rise. It's been stellar. Reaching full professor status in the year 2000, just 8 years after completing her postdoctoral research fellowship at UW. Her training includes a science doctorate in epidemiology in 1991 from Harvard University, a science master's in demography in 1988 from Harvard, a master's in science and civil engineering in 1986 from Tufts University, and her bachelor's degree in biology and genetics in 1984, of course, from Princeton. During her career, she's also been honored as a recipient of summarized her career by saying, Dr. Williams has published extensively and is known internationally for her work in reproductive health and epidemiology. Now, before I end, I want to take a moment and cite something from Bronson, Samet, and Thacker's AJE article. And they were talking, they were reviewing the factors contributing to successful careers in epidemiology. And they looked at the highest ranked characteristics of effective career mentors. And listen closely, because I'm going to read a few quotes from the people that wrote in that really resonate with these items that Dr. Williams excels at. High integrity, inspiration and encouragement, thorough knowledge of subject matter, accessibility, asking of challenging questions, willingness to share credit, willingness to make education a priority, and numerous good contacts in the profession. So I'm going to try to end this by just reading a few quotes, and if I go too long, just give me the high sign, because I've got a lot more here, and I'm not going to read it all. But one of her international students said, I was greatly impressed by her ability to guide me in preparing manuscripts for international journals. Without her encouragement, I would not have gone this far. She is easily accessible for advice and assistance, and she always gives me a quick response to my questions. From students from the Merck program, she taught the students not only through instruction, but by example. The most amazing thing to me that Dr. Williams has moved, that Dr. Williams has moved beyond the American academic boundary. She knows how to connect people across cultures. Another international graduate student said she provided me with a with personal support comparable to one I received from my family. She continuously tried to build my self-esteem and confidence by providing me with constructive comments and non-judgmental suggestions. Another student said that she is a symbol of what an academician should strive to be. At the home front, some of her UW students commented by writing, Michelle is an amazing person. She looks out for students who are marginalized, either because of lack of communication or their own personal background. She makes her best to connect them and help them. She fights their battle. She could be at Heathrow Airport after 12 hours of flight, or in Lima, Peru, working on a broken computer keyboard, or in Ethiopia, so many miles away. Her unwavering commitment to helping her students is inspirational. Briefly, one other student said, she's helped me fall in love with epidemiology over and over. Another one said, she helped me visualize my expectations, setting the bar higher. Many other testimonials that I will sum up here. Her department chair said that I have seldom seen such strong support and praise for a teacher. She is truly one of the best. Michelle Williams is a brilliant scientist, and her greatest strength is her ability to lead with her heart. That was a student. She puts her best into everything from work, family, mentoring, and personal relations. She has a big heart. Shows big time. Finally,
especially thank my parents. As Jim mentioned, both my parents, Nolan and Juleta Williams, had not the privileges that I had to attend graduate school. Combined, they had less than 6 years of education. But they were wise enough people to understand that there is good debt, and investing in education is a good debt. And why is investing in education a good debt? It's a good debt because it adds value. An education in epidemiology, for me, adds value to creating and enhancing life. And I think it's a real honor to have an award in the name of Abraham Lilienfeld. I'm deeply touched to receive that honor because in learning about Abe, I understand that we share the same belief. In my heart and in my soul, like Abe, I do believe that epidemiology is a wonderful, fundamental way for understanding and solving problems. And investing in epidemiology learning means investing in solving problems, saving lives, creating and enhancing life. Education, investment in education, particularly in epidemiology and public health, is good debt because it enhances lives and it saves lives. Maya Angelou once said, when you learn, teach. If I may be so presumptuous, I'd like to edit Maya Angelou, one of our nation's poet laureates. I would say, when you learn, teach, and when you teach, you learn. I've learned so much from my students. It's an awesome responsibility to bear the title of teacher. It's awesome because on a given day in your classroom, you might have a student who spent the first year of her life in the arms of a homeless, countryless woman, walking along the Pan-American Highway, escaping civil war in El Salvador. Or on a given day, you may have what is now known as a lost boy in your classroom who spent 10 years in a Kenyan refugee camp and by magic and grace ends up in your classroom and is learning epidemiology and is learning public health and is reconciling some things that may have happened in their lives and understand that their investment in the debt that their family extended and immediate family has gone into to get them to that place. It's good debt. For me, it's an honor every day to encounter a classroom of people, whether they're third-generation college students or first-generation Americans having an opportunity to get beyond the third grade. It's an honor and a privilege and a pleasure for them to share with me that part of their life's journey that they will spend in my classroom, whether it's a traditional classroom or a classroom that happens somewhere in a village. And for me, they energize me and they give me an opportunity to imagine a greater society where they, along with their teachers, are participating in creating and enhancing a better way of living and creating a society that's sustainable and just. Teaching means a lot to me. Having an opportunity to share my knowledge and my love and passion for epidemiology has really been a privilege. I just say one last thing. Many of us in my generation didn't know about epidemiology until long after graduating from liberal arts schools. Imagine an undergraduate education where epidemiology is taught as one of the fundamental core courses in a curriculum of liberal arts education. Epidemiology is truly, as Abe felt, that it is a method, a way of approaching problems, identifying them, and identifying solutions. And we heard that so elegantly this evening on the talk of the cancer epidemiology overview. But epidemiology is useful way beyond clinical science. We all know this in our work in social justice and
recognize community-based public health action, but also early career awards. This award is designed to showcase an organization or an individual project that demonstrates measurable relevance to public health improvements. And the awardees will receive an inscribed clock that has both a map indicating the importance of both space and time in what they're doing, the timeliness of their efforts. This year, I'm delighted to tell you that our winner is Bureau of Tobacco Control for the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. The New York City's history of public health began in the early 1800s when the city controlled epidemics of yellow fever and cholera. Today, the department is the primary public health agency for more than 8 million ethnically and socioeconomically diverse people in New York City. In 2002, the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene launched an aggressive, comprehensive tobacco control program with two goals. Number one, making it harder to smoke, and number two, making it easier to quit. The program was comprised of five components: taxation, legal action, cessation, public education, and evaluation. This has included 2002 increase in New York City's cigarette excise tax and the passage of the Smoke-Free and Air Act, banning indoor public smoking. Between 2003 and 2006, the Bureau of Tobacco Control within the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene focused the provision of cessation services to New York City smokers. This included giving away nearly 250,000 courses of nicotine replacement therapy, providing face-to-face education of healthcare providers and their staff, and coordinating cessation services with the city's public hospital system. In 2006, the Bureau launched its largest media campaign in history, airing television ads that depict graphic effects of smoking and provide information on how New Yorkers who smoke can get help in quitting. Throughout the implementation, the Bureau prioritized use of epidemiologic methods and data sources. The nicotine replacement program was provided to approximately 5% of all adults in New York who smoked 10 cigarettes or more daily, and the formal assessment of the program resulted in an estimated smoking cessation rate of 20% within 6 months. Dr. Jennifer A. Ellis will be accepting on behalf of the New York City Bureau of Tobacco Control. Please join me in congratulating this achievement.
Good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Ellis, and I have the pleasure of being the Director of Research and Evaluation for the New York City Department of Health's Bureau of Tobacco Control. It is a tremendous honor to be here today to accept this Public Health Practice Award on behalf of the Bureau. We are proud to be recognized by the Epidemiology Section of the APHA, especially since our goals as a Bureau include as a top priority using epidemiologic methods to successfully implement programs to reduce smoking prevalence in New York City. Of course, the work of the Bureau requires continual collaboration throughout the Health Department. In particular, the leadership and vision provided by Commissioner Thomas Frieden, Deputy Commissioner Mary Bassett, and the Bureau's Assistant Commissioner Sarah Pearl, and the support and guidance of the Bureau of Epidemiology Services have made it possible to continually improve our use of applied epidemiology to inform programs that reduce smoking in New York City. As the Director of Research for the Bureau, it has been my personal honor to help shape the epidemiologic methods that we use to understand and enhance our progress in reducing smoking. It has been the use of applied epidemiologic methods that have helped us to both understand our progress and refine our programs. For example, since 2001, New York City has successfully reduced smoking prevalence by 20% in adults and 36% in youth, resulting in at least 250,000 fewer smokers in New York City. As part of our use of applied epidemiology to refine programs, we've identified subgroups within the city that have made less progress and are in the process of enhancing programs that reach these populations. As Dr. Wilson mentioned, we have distributed more than 250,000 courses of nicotine replacement therapy, and we continually advise our outreach strategies based on real-time analyses of enrollment data demographics. We have aired the largest anti-tobacco campaign in agency history, and we collect cohort data on both reach and effectiveness of each ad we air. calls to the city for help quitting smoking have quadrupled as a result of our program efforts. On a personal note, as someone who started her career in academia and switched somewhat unexpectedly to public health practice, I find it a sincere pleasure to do this work. It is inspiring, challenging, and exhilarating, particularly during a time when the use of epidemiologic methods has resulted in the measurement of real successes in reducing smoking. On behalf of the Bureau and the agency, I want to thank you again for having me here today and for recognizing our work. Thank you.
Graduate training, and Andrea, who's doing an MD PhD for the PhD percent from public schools, and almost 500 scholarship winners with $1.8 million in scholarship awards. Diane often receives emails and notes from parents and students, and one student who was in last year's competition wrote her and said, "A hot topic among the students was how big we all think this competition will get. You already give more scholarships than Intel or Siemens, Westinghouse, and this competition is also more accessible than the other competitions. You don't have to be in a high-tech lab and discover a new gene. And the topics, the work that you do, can be explained to a lay audience and made relevant. So I'm telling everyone in my school's research program to do epidemiology next year and enter the competition, and many others are doing the same." We have two of our national winners from last year here to receive awards. And I just want to tell you a little tiny bit about them, ma'am, and their projects. Oh, but Julie's here. Yeah. So we have Julie Reckel, who's at the University of Richmond now. Julie's project was a comparison of practice and competition-related injuries among high school athletes participating in 9 sports during the 2005-2006 year. And I can tell you from listening to Julie's presentation twice in last year's competition that she knew her data. She was involved in the validity of the data collection. It was a massive database. She learned classic statistical techniques and to do her comparisons. And the most exciting thing of all was that she had that revelatory experience of coming up with something that might not have been expected. And you're going to have to ask her what that was. But I'll give you a hint. After you adjust for the hours spent in competition and practice, when do you think most of the injuries occur? But you'll have to ask Julie for the answer. Now, why might Julie have been motivated to study in this area? Well, in addition to being a stellar student and a brilliant researcher, she's also a national level junior triathlete. The other student who's here with us today, a national winner, is William Slack. William is an extremely original thinker. His topic was teen drug, alcohol, and tobacco use, a social network examination. And I hasten to add that he did not do this project because of his interest in any of these particular substances. He did this because he's very interested in how society and our social systems influence health decisions and behaviors. And he did something, you can learn a lot from these brilliant YES High School students. He wanted to do a new methodology he did his own social network analysis, not with a software program, not by using somebody else's method. He did a social network analysis himself, coded the dots, drew the lines, figured out the combinations, and in doing so, found some very interesting intervention points that might be useful. So they're exciting, and Robin's been a judge with us. And I think there's a great future. When you meet these students, when you hear their presentations, and when you see what they go on to do, there's a great future for epidemiology here.
So for the YES students, when I call your name, would you please come forward, and then we'll all take a picture as a group. William Slack, for his work as a National Young Epidemiology Scholar, winner entitled Teen Drug, Alcohol, and Tobacco Use, a Social Network Examination.
Thank you.
purchase with fast food consumption, pre- and post-intervention, a study using data from the Apache Healthy Store